It's the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of filmstage.com, and I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, joined as always by my two partners in crime. There is Danny King, a writer for the Film Stage.
Hello, welcome to the Film Stage Show.
And Nick Newman, an associate editor for the Film Stage.
Hello.
All right. You know, I always kind of call you an associate editor. Is there another associate editor? Is that correct?
Nope. Or
are you the associate editor? So that you are the one and only associate editor.
Yeah.
There are no other associates. All right, excellent. Today, anyone who joins us regularly knows that we usually start off with a movie discussion based around news or some trends that we want to talk about before getting into our full review, spoilerific at the later half, and then going into our look at the week ahead. However, this week's going to be a little bit different because of scheduling and general malaise. We're actually going to be doing two reviews. The first will be a brief review of Silver Linings Playbook, because Danny and I saw that, but Nick couldn't find the time to do it. And then we'll be doing our full review of Anna Karenina, the newest film by director Joe Wright, who did Hannah and Atonement. And then we'll be doing all of our look forward to the week ahead stuff. So if you were tuning in to see how we felt about, I don't even know what you would have expected us to talk about, not a really big week in news for films. Sorry to disappoint, but you're going to get two reviews for the price of one podcast. So I don't want to hear any complaining about it. However, if you would like to complain about it, you can get in touch with us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. And you can also leave a comment on our iTunes page, and you can
Not
subscribe
bad.
To us there. Not bad?
Not a bad way to plug.
No, thank you. I did not even... This isn't like a script. I always do this off the cuff. So I'm pleased with myself. Moving on. So let's get right into it. Because we do have two films, we don't want to take up too much of your time. Let us talk about the Silver Linings Playbook. Just Silver Linings Playbook. I know. I keep appending definite articles onto movies that
drop
don't have any.
Drop the.
That is... That's going to be my Excelsior. Every time I'm having a problem, I'm going to scream drop the. Anyway, this is the new film by David O. Russell, who did Three Kings and The Fighter and I Heart Huckabees. It stars Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, along with Robert De Niro and Chris Tucker, along with a few other people that you'll probably recognize from various places. And let's dive right into it. This is the movie that is about a man who is institutionalized with bipolar disorder after a violent incident. And then he gets back into the world, wants to put his life together, and that sort of involves dealing with another emotionally and possibly mentally disturbed young woman and learning to dance with her. That is absolutely tragic as far as my ability to summarize this movie. There's a lot more to it than that. I'm sure we'll get into it during this review. Nick, you did not see this film, correct?
No, I've been too busy, unfortunately, to go out.
Okay, before we actually get into the people who saw it, I wanted to get your opinions on it just from kind of looking at it. Like, what did you think it was going to be like, and how did you react to the trailer?
The trailer I was a little mixed on. I was surprised that it came from David O. Russell because it looked a little lighter and schmaltzier than I would normally expect from someone of his stripe. And the reaction is kind of... The reaction to this movie has been weird because it played at Toronto in September and everybody was ecstatic about it. We gave it an A, for instance. But as it's climbed out into theatrical release, it's sort of been getting it has, you know, high percentage of Rotten Tomatoes and whatnot, but I've heard much more mixed reactions. I know someone, a trustworthy person, actually thinks that this is one of the worst films of the year, for instance.
Huh.
So it's been interesting to follow that, and it doesn't necessarily make me want to see it more, but it has given it, I think, a more worthwhile context than just the trailer would, which made it look a little flat.
All right. Yeah, no, flat is definitely how I would summarize how I felt walking into this film. It does have that, I don't know, it just doesn't seem like a David O. Russell film. You know, looking at, even at just Three Kings and I Heart Huckabees, he's much more interesting and abrasive than this movie kind of made itself out to look in the trailers. So, Danny, let's get into it with you. What were your thoughts on this before you saw it, just to kind of give the people at home an idea of where we're coming from in our opinions as far as expectations versus reality, and then tell us what you actually thought of it.
Yeah, sure. So I actually had some fairly detailed expectations for this movie because I read the novel back in the summer, which was written by Matthew Quick. And one of the things that struck me about the novel, which I really liked, was that it seemed to speak to a lot of themes that David O. Russell explored in The Fighter, in terms of the film is Robert De Niro's character, for instance, plays like a sports addict, basically. And there's a lot of things about how his sports addiction kind of affects his relationships with his family. And that's obviously in The Fighter there. There's also kind of this idea of mental illness, like a male character that is kind of off the rails. And when I sort of saw those things in the novel, I was excited because I really liked The Fighter. I think it was a really gritty movie and pretty powerful. I liked it a lot more the second time I saw it. And Silver Linings Playbook is weirder because it sort of has the same style as The Fighter in terms of trying to be this like grounded, realistic family, kind of look at this family, but it has a much less believable world in terms of the personalities are sort of like, if you've seen David O. Russell's Flirting with Disaster, everyone's kind of crazy. And they're crazy to the extent that you almost don't believe them. And it sort of works at odds with his approach to filmmaking here, which is like very realistic and gritty. So that makes it, that makes the movie kind of dim as I think about it more, because I saw it about a month ago. But yeah, in terms of expectations, I sort of got into the movie a little bit there. But my expectations were high based on having read the novel and based on like the similarities I saw with The Fighter.
Okay, yeah, my expectations in this is meh. It looks interesting. It looked kind of good. It was nice to see Bradley Cooper extending himself into a role that wasn't just, you know, usual charming, you know, slick guy doing stuff that's probably bad. I mean, it still is a little bit like that, but he does appear to actually do some acting in the trailer. So, I mean, I was sort of into it, but at the same time, this, the way that it was posited was like this affirming, like, movie where a guy with a problem finds himself an activity and a person that allows him to move above that, which just like, I don't know, that's been done before. It's not the interesting ideas that I prefer to see before, and it doesn't have what appears to be a centerpiece performance that really would bring me into it. But, you know, I don't know. I was so ambivalent towards it, so almost dispassionate, actually, in the way that I was looking at it. It just, I don't know. But I went to see it anyway, because it has been getting, as Nick said, a lot of interesting notices. They've gotten slightly more negative as time has gone on. I haven't seen anyone who's called it the worst of the year, I don't think. But unfortunately, you know, I feel like every movie that comes out, no matter how good it is, someone has to say that it's the worst of the year. So I don't know how much I actually give that statement anymore. But I don't know. When I went and actually watched it, you know, it starts off high, and then I get disappointed in it. And then once I've adjusted for the disappointment I'm feeling, it kind of planes off and then occasionally bumps itself up, in my opinion. Which doesn't sound like a recommendation, but it kind of functions as one. I enjoyed this movie pretty much. I don't know. I'm still so sort of dispassionate on it. Like, there are moments of real pathos and emotion that worked for me, but everything in between that was that simple, normal movie that I figured it would be. You know, nothing terrible, but nothing spectacular. Just kind of there. And
really regretting not going to see this now.
Why is that?
That's a joke.
Oh, okay. I thought you were trying to say something about our contentious relationship and how you probably would have thought that it would have been fantastic.
No, that's not what I meant.
No, I mean, I think it feels to me like that this would be the way that most people would see this film. I don't say that because I'm an everyman and my opinion is universal, but I mean, I can admit the high points. I mean, it's nice to see De Niro acting again, doing some actual like emoting and inhabiting a character that's more than just Robert De Niro looking for a paycheck. And in general, it's interesting to see this condition that Bradley Cooper's character has, his name is Pat, and he has or had undiagnosed bipolar disorder. And bipolar disorder is one of those mental conditions that it gets thrown around a lot, like when your friend is just being a jerk after he was pretty cool for a while, and you're just like, man, stop being so bipolar. Like, but no one really gets what it means. So I was interested in seeing that and really getting a good look at that and seeing what they would do with that on a story level. But as Danny was saying, the characters in it are a little bit too nuts. Like, everyone has something wrong with them. And that really blunts whatever impact his disorder would have, because it's like, well, he's no more crazy than the rest of these imbeciles. So that kind of, that, to the extent that the movie didn't work, that was what didn't work for me, was just the idea that, like, literally everyone around him was so messed up that it didn't give me a baseline of health for his character. And that made it really hard to see his struggle outside of just the world is crazy. I don't know if you agree with that, Danny.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with you, like, in a big picture sense, that, like, the movie, while you're watching it, is satisfying and, like, easily recommendable. But as you kind of spin away from it, it just sort of, like, becomes a little bit forgettable. I really like the performances in it. You mentioned before how you, like, were a bit skeptical of Bradley Cooper. But I've kind of liked him in a few films, and I thought he was really good here, and Jennifer Lawrence is terrific, I think. But it is just that sense of, like, once you step back from the movie and think about it, it becomes less and less believable. And even, like, people praising De Niro for, like, giving a performance for the first time in years, which I don't necessarily agree with, but his character is completely absurd in terms of, like, his superstitions.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And kind of what he's doing, that it just took me out of scenes. And, like, the more I think about it, the more kind of disposable it seems.
Yeah, I mean, especially, we're not going to get into the ending specifically because we don't want to, you know, run a spoiler on this. Especially, you know, we don't want to ruin it for you, Nick. But I don't know. There's something about the entire setup for the climax of the movie depended on everyone just kind of either abusing or playing along with the serious mental and emotional problems of every other character. And I had a really uncomfortable moment watching that all cohese together into, like, the final stakes. And that was really odd for me. It was hard to get behind. But, I mean, Bradley Cooper does do a good job, and some of what they talk about in the film really is stuff that people with bipolar disorder have to deal with. These delusions that he has about people working against him, or this idea that even people who want him around secretly hate him. Like, these are things that I've had to deal with. I don't have bipolar disorder, but I know a few people who do. And you have to really make adjustments in your life and in yourself to deal with that. And it's tough, and it's impossible to understand what's going on with these people, because it's just so far outside of your own personal experience. But like I said, in this movie, every character is so arch and crazy that sometimes when he had that sense, I kind of had that sense with him. But it wasn't because the movie was trying to give me his subjective point of view. It was because everyone in the movie was nuts. Specifically, Julia Stiles' character gets involved in this a lot as, like, his best friend's wife. And so, yeah, it was really difficult for me to really get behind the movie, even as a portrayal of that. And I think that actually it diminishes Cooper's performance a bit. And then there's Jennifer Lawrence, who doesn't even get a specific diagnosis. She just gets a lot of problems that are related to something.
Just one other aspect of the story that I'll touch on really quick. And it's something that I was a little bit nervous about when I read the book, which is that, you know, at the start of the film, Bradley Cooper's character is coming out of this mental institution, and he's separated from his wife. It might be a divorce, I'm not even sure, but there's, like, a restraining order. But everything he does is kind of, like, motivated by this desire to get her back. And that's really tough to buy, especially because, like, he's hanging out with Jennifer Lawrence the whole movie. And even though, you know, her character's supposed to be nuts, like, she's awesome. So, like,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
It's, like, one of those movies.
And especially, like, there's never really a sense, because the ex-wife character is, like, pretty much an off-screen presence, there's never really a sense that that's a realistic option. And while you can make the argument that that's sort of a depiction of his mental illness. It still wasn't really like a convincing element of the story for me.
And the other problem, this is probably my last thing that I'll beat up on the movie for, is that everything that he says about his relationship with his ex-wife or, you know, estranged wife is like a real problem that they had. Like, there's a scene where he says, "We had a great relationship. It made people uncomfortable because they didn't get it. We just really wanted to change one another. Like, I wanted her to dress differently. She wanted me to not be vaguely psychotic." And I was like, that's not a good relationship. And I can see that he wouldn't see that, but you have to let me know why both of them thought that this was a good idea to begin with. And the only flash that we get of their past is like a terrible incident that happened. And that's not enough. So I couldn't even buy that. So yeah, his arc moving towards redemption with his wife was basically a non-starter for me. Like, I knew that was never going to happen, especially because Jennifer Lawrence is there with her big dark eyes looking up at him all the time. It's just like, I know that that's the way it's going to happen. But, you know, in general, I wouldn't tell people not to see it. I'm just a little, in a director like David O. Russell's hands, who has this kind of dark streak to him and is really never flinched from making a character like an anti-hero, like a really hardline anti-hero, but with like a small touch that makes him relatable. Yeah, I felt a little let down by the fact that this movie seemed to let Bradley Cooper's character off the hook so much. And that's all I've got to say.
Jeff Wells is going to punch refrigerator now.
Yeah.
What, did Jeff Wells like this?
He is, I mean, for those who aren't listening, Jeff Wells is this cranky old asshole who runs his own website. and he is obsessed with this film and verbally attacks anybody who does not say this is a great movie. So
we should have got.
Yeah, he basically has a new piece every week.
Manolo Dargis of the New York Times wrote a negative review of the movie, and he said on his website, he said, "Reading this, I want to punch a refrigerator, or something like that."
Maybe he has bipolar disorder.
No, I was joking. How he probably likes this film so much because it's about a, you know, a medicated psychotic who can't control himself. But
yeah. I don't know. I guess I got to look out for a punch from Jeff Wells now. That's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Even though, like I said, you know, it's pretty good. And I really do feel like Bradley Cooper does such a good job in this movie that I feel let down that he is surrounded by people who let his character off the hook when he's honestly coming at it from a pretty earnest and like honest angle. So yeah, I'm a little disappointed. I'm a little upset that I didn't like this movie more, but you know, it's whatever. John Ortiz is in it. He's got a fun character. But again, he's so crazy that it's hard to get past. Chris Tucker also does some good work in this, which is weird to say out loud. But yeah, if we don't have anything more to say about this, I think we can move on into our feature review of Anna Karenina.
Yeah.
All right. So Anna Karenina, the new film based on the classic novel, usually voted one of the best novels ever written, which is by Leo Tolstoy. Directed by Joe Wright, screenplay by Tom Stoppard, and this stars, I should really take a deep breath because there's a lot of people in this, but I'll just stick with the top few. Keira Knightley as Anna Karenina, Jude Law as her husband, and then
wait a second, I have to interrupt here. This is actually really ironic. Jeff Wells, we have to go back to him, okay. Said the thing about the refrigerator, not because Manolo Dargis gave a negative review to Silver Linings, but because she gave a negative review to Anna Karenina.
Oh, really?
Isn't that funny how it works out?
So yeah, he loves both of them.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Crazy. Well,
he's really not going to like this podcast then.
No. Well, I'll defend Anna Karenina a little bit. Oh, we're jumping ahead. Anyway, as I was saying, Keira Knightley, Jude Law, Aaron Taylor Johnson, Matthew McFadden, Kelly MacDonald, and Domhnall Gleeson? Is that pronounced correct? Anyone know?
No. Don't know.
No idea.
Sounds
sorry,
good.
Sorry, Dom, if I pronounced your name wrong. But yes, Anna Karenina.
I was 18 when I got married. But it was not love. Your husband is a saint, and we must all cherish him for Russia's sake.
Romantic love will be the last illusion of the old order.
Have you known Count Vronsky long?
He's a rich, good-looking cavalry officer. Dance with me.
So Anna Karenina is the story of Anna Karenina, who is married to Alexei Karenin, and she is a society wife in 1870s Russia who falls in love with a cavalry officer, and that is the propelling narrative engine of this story, though it also deals with another character named Levin, who is in love with a woman named Kitty, who was spurned by the Count Vronsky that Anna fell in love with and who fell in love with her. So it is a emotional tetrahedron that they have to work through, and it explores the way that love and passion and society clash to create tragic circumstances. I know that last week we got into a little bit of Nick's feelings on this, so we're going to hold off on that. Let's start with Danny again and get your basic feelings on Anna Karenina.
My basic feelings were pretty mixed. I really like respect the idea that Joe Wright kind of took this adaptation in a kind of wonky direction. And I sort of equate my feelings of this movie with Andrea Arnold's recent adaptation of Wuthering Heights, which both movies have this kind of exciting sense of like they're almost bored with their source materials. And I think that's kind of exciting just because they're such revered novels, and the way that both films are directed, it's like they could almost just care less about what they're working with and they want to make it cinematic. And I think that's interesting. But the movie's like tone just kind of confused me. And it was sort of like an emotionally stale thing for me the whole way through. I don't really think there's anything wrong with the cast. It's just like, I wasn't sure if it was meant to be this really emotionally powerful kind of character story, or if it was meant to be more of like a director's kind of commentary on a classical novel. And I feel like the first half is more of the directorial commentary and the second half tries to become more narrative. And it didn't quite mesh for me. But in general, I'm sort of a big fan of Joe Wright, and there's definitely a lot of interesting things going on. But I was left a little distant from it.
Well, that was the tempered review.
So yeah.
Let's give Nick his moment to talk about his feelings on Anna Karenina.
I hate this movie. And I went into it a little... Okay, I will admit I went in a little ambivalent because I'm not a particularly big Joe Wright fan. I've seen Atonement and Hannah, so I guess... I broke the streak of seeing every other film of his now because I haven't seen Pride and Prejudice or The Soloist. But, Atonement I liked when I saw it, but I was younger and didn't have quite as good taste. So I don't know, maybe I'll go back and watch it and feel the same way I do about this film. And then Hannah, I mean, I've sort of said my bit on that before, but I think that film is abominable and just a spit in the face to so many better action filmmakers from world cinema. But let's not get into that now. Anna Karenina, I think the biggest problem is that it's, you know, Danny, you say that this is a movie that really couldn't care less about its source material, the Tolstoy novel of the same name. And I completely agree, but I don't think this film is really faithful to its own conceit, its own mode of deviation, which is supposed to make it unique. I don't know if this is been mentioned yet, but the movie operates on this level where you have a stage setting for the film and the environment is changing around them as scenes play out, but that only happens initially, and as the movie goes on it just becomes a more traditional costume drama, and I forgot that such a conceit was supposed to even exist here, and I could not tap into any of the emotions here. I thought it was completely dead on arrival as a motion picture.
Ouch. Okay, we've touched on the source material like twice now. Who here has actually read Anna Karenina?
I have not.
No.
Okay. I have read Anna Karenina 3 times.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm not saying that to be. I guess I'm bragging a little bit.
I know.
Yeah. I love Anna Karenina. It's a great novel, and there are moments in it of such incisive, insightful commentary on society and people in general, and it still plays as very much of a modern novel even when you read it now. When I found out that Joe Wright was adapting it, I was pretty excited, but also pretty upset, because I loved Atonement, and Atonement is also based off of a novel that I loved called Atonement, obviously, by Ian McEwan. And I thought that he took a tricky novel that it could be sort of like Life of Pi-esque in the unadaptable category, just because of the sort of tricks that it plays with the idea of a storytelling device. And yet he was able to pull it off pretty well. And it was also just well shot and well acted, blah, blah, blah. I still enjoy Atonement. I watched it a week or two ago. I'm not sure if that was my recommended viewing. It probably should have been, but whatever. Hannah, I enjoy. I thought it was fun, energetic. I love the music. I thought that the action was well directed and choreographed and paced. Nick, I know this is going to put us on a collision course that will only continue when I say that currently Anna Karenina is one of my favorite movies of the year. The facts that I figured out at some point before I ever saw the movie that he actually did decide to deviate from simple period drama costumes and sweeping estates and all this cobblestone nonsense that usually gets put into a period piece excited me. And the fact that he took a great undercurrent of the novel, which was the aspect of society being a stage on which everyone plays and we're all looking at one another and seeing how we're acting, and actually making it not just subtextual, but making it the actual setting of his movie, was novel and interesting, and I wasn't sure if he could pull it off. But I think that he actually did really well, and I never lost sight of that. I think that every scene has its place. Every time that a character's in a specific part of this abandoned theater that everything takes place in really does make a statement about what is happening in that scene and what is going on and who's watching and what the impact of your actions are going to have. Every time that they leave the theater and actually move out into the real world, you get a sense of the freedom and the odd kind of isolation that not being within a closed space will give you. So I liked that. Just on that basic level, I thought that that conceit played out very well. That's to say nothing of the choreography of some of the scenes when the scene sort of changes around these people, or the way the set dressing reflects certain characters' interior points of view. I thought the acting was pretty much universally great. I thought that they did maintain the kind of ambiguous nature of every character from the novel. In fact, they did a lot to soften Count Vronsky in this movie, who in the book comes off as a little bit of a rake and a rogue, and I don't like him. I've read it three times, and each time I expect to like him a little more, because maybe my prudish morals have loosened a bit. But no, he's still kind of a thoughtless dick. But in this movie, they did a good job of easing that a little bit. And Tom Stoppard, he had this almost impossible thing, because if Peter Jackson has taught us anything, it's that you can take a single book and turn it into three movies. And Tom Stoppard had to do the opposite. He had to take a novel that could definitely have been made into like a 12-hour long miniseries and condense it down into about 2 hours. And yeah, he had to excise a lot of stuff. I could spend an hour running through everything that he had to take out, but I think that he actually did do a pretty good job of condensing it. And I don't know, it flowed for me. The story was resonant. I can't understand most of the problems that people seem to have with this movie. So that's where I'm coming from. And I look forward to being challenged on those beliefs, because maybe I'm just blinded by my love of the book. I don't know. I'm interested to hear more about why people thought that it was not so good.
Well, one thing that's interesting about the idea of like the stage reflecting society is that I actually didn't think the movie was really about its setting, in the sense that like when I saw the trailer, there were like taglines like "an affair that shocked a nation" and stuff like that. So I was expecting there to be more sort of political discussion and discussion about how this affair would actually like affect the nation. But it really plays like an intimate, like closed door relationship drama a lot of the time. And I liked that because I assumed that some of the political talk would be like boring, but it also almost counteracts the idea of the stage decision reflecting society, because I didn't really get a sense of the world in which they were living in. I don't know if you did or not.
Well, I definitely did. But again, because I read the novel, I might have been more primed for those This is almost the exact opposite problem I had with Lawless and reading the wettest county in the world. And not only that, but Cosmopolis, where those, like, knowing what was going on actually hurt the movies for me a little bit, just because I felt like I was missing the impact. Yeah, I know. I thought that they did a good job of showing first of all, the tagline, "The Affair That Shocked the Nation," is something that some marketing dude had to come up with to give this more weight, and damn him for it, because that the second you said that, I'd never seen that tagline. I actually winced a little bit. Like, I would not want to see a movie that had that as a tagline. But you do get, I feel, in this movie, a sense that society has kind of turned its back on her for doing these things. And the worst part about it for her is that everyone knows that everyone's having some kind of an affair. It's just kind of known. There's even a point where one character says, you know, an affair with a married woman is like the crowning achievement of any young officer's career. And so it's not so much what they're doing as the fact that they're doing it on a stage where people can see them. Like, I thought that that came through very clear. I thought that that was a pretty obvious thing that they had done. Like, there were so many moments where you can see people just shocked that the way they're acting out in the world where people are watching. Am I
like, yeah, no, definitely. Like, there was no shortage of, like, people talking about how promiscuous her behavior was. I guess I was just sort of surprised that the movie didn't feel like an epic kind of thing to me. And maybe that was just because of the prestige of the novel and sort of like some of the production value, but it really did sort of play like a, even despite all the directorial like flourishes and stuff, it played like kind of a small scale relationship drama.
Nick, did you have a similar issue with this?
Yeah, I found the visual construction of the movie to be very confused and awkward. I mentioned how the stage setting is completely shirked about 40 minutes in, and then it felt like it just appeared whenever Joe Wright felt that it would be appropriate for it to appear, but without rhyme or reason to it. And that kept taking me out of the movie. And but furthermore, I went into this expecting something that had a bit more zest to it. And I know that to go in with expectations for anything can be a little, it can be a little dangerous, but I do think that the movie is setting you up for something that is completely different, and then it's not. And I was thinking to myself, well, why didn't you take that extra step? Why didn't you do all of that? It was infuriating to me.
So what kind of extra zest were you looking for?
Well, I mean, I'm talking about the construction that's here, where you have this revolving, these revolving sets and the way it's completely transforming itself as the film goes on. I think that one of the only moments past the half-hour mark where it felt noticeable was a horse race scene, which I actually liked. I thought that was...
Yeah, that was a really good scene.
Yeah, I loved the horse race.
But when I saw that and I liked it, that just reminded me how much I would have preferred that he kept it in. And then when it goes back to just these small interiors with people in the costumes, it felt flat.
Okay. I can get behind that. That's nothing that I can really speak against. That's weird.
One thing you said earlier was you talked about how you like how ambiguous he made the characters. And I feel like that almost worked to a fault for me, where I didn't really understand them, especially Keira Knightley's Anna Karenina. I mean, I have no problems with the performances. I just never really kind of connected with her as like this tragic figure. I didn't really understand her psychology.
Okay. And again, that's going to be one of those things where I, having read the book, might have had a little more involvement in that.
See, I haven't read the book and I felt the same way as Danny, so I think that
I know. So this is
the same problem here.
This is the same problem I had with The Hunger Games, actually, was I was like, you know, I know a lot of people who kind of like this and they've read the damn book and I have no idea. But I mean, I could, again, I feel like reading the book actually, walking out of the theater each time I've seen it, I've currently seen it twice, and it's amazing the fact that a lot of people in the theater that I've read, when listening to their reactions, who've read the book had major issues with it, and a lot of the people who hadn't read the book didn't have any of those issues with it. So I feel like this, we're the perfect like minority in the polar opposite opinions, because I heard people after the movie being like, I can't believe they cut out this. I can't believe Vronsky wasn't more of a dick. I can't believe that they softened this or that. And yet here I am, and I'm like, no, I kind of like that. I enjoy the fact that they tweaked it. I wasn't looking for a complete and utter table reading like Cosmopolis felt like. And...
Ooh.
Oh, burn on Cosmopolis.
Burn.
Yeah, so it's weird. It's weird that we're having this kind of polar reaction. As far as the kind of claustrophobic nature of the film, I think is what Danny had been getting at some point. I think that that worked for me just kind of in showing that there's not a lot of other places to go. Like, society is closed in. You can't get out of it. Maybe if they made the theater bigger, maybe if they had more actors. I don't know. I have absolutely no idea how to help that. But I loved it. And it's so weird that things like that were problems for you and I was able to get over them. And that other people who read the book apparently had similar issues. It's kind of blowing my mind. I'm a little lost right now. I feel like I've entered an inverse world. But I think one of the things about, and I won't even call the, I may have called the characters ambiguous. I think what I should have said was a little less pat and linear than I would expect. I feel like they're more real people than you'd expect from a movie like this. You want the hero and the villain. And the crazy thing is that each person kind of takes their time swapping that, in my opinion anyway. Like, the role of the real antagonist only ever really gets permanently saddled on the strictures of society.
The antagonist is desire.
Okay, if that is another tagline for this movie, I'm going to burn every poster I see. Oh, God. No, the funny thing is, the antagonist isn't even desire, because like I said, there are points in the movie where they're like, look, everyone's fucking someone's wife, it doesn't matter. But what matters is that you're coming out and actually doing it, showing your passion in public, which is just not allowed. A character literally at some point says it would be okay if she broke the law, but she broke the rules. And it's like, yeah, there is this polite way that things are supposed to be dealt with, and it's just wrong that you happen to have allowed that to encroach outward. Like, letting your interior life and your actual desires in yourself out, like breaking your role that you've been stuck with, is a bad thing. It's the same reason that people are disgusted with Levin's brother, because he is common law married to a woman that he found in a brothel. And even Levin, who's supposed to be the most enlightened character in all this, and is probably my favorite character in all of fiction, he has an issue with her being in his house and wants his wife to not even look at her. And she ends up being even more enlightened than he is and goes and helps take care of his brother. Like, things like that. This movie and the novel in and of itself, I mean, they just have this fluid, very humanistic nature where no one is a real villain. And I appreciated that. And I didn't have a problem with having characters whose role in protagonist-antagonist was softened a bit.
Even though I, you know, really, really do not like this film, I do want to throw out one positive. I quite like the scene where Levin is playing with the wooden blocks and
yes.
He's spelling out something.
You actually
I don't necessarily
like
want to say, because it's kind of a spoiler, but
right,
you know.
We can get into that in spoilers. But you actually sincerely liked that scene. You're not just saying that because
yeah.
like it was funny to you.
No,
yeah,
I like that.
I like that scene too. In a lot of ways, the romance between Levin and Kitty kind of resonated more for me than Knightley and Aaron Taylor Johnson and as Vronsky.
Okay, this is exciting for me because that's what's supposed to happen. I think we could probably get into spoilers right now because we're kind of hedging in that direction. So final thoughts on the film in a general sense before we actually start getting into... I mean, the problem with this is it's a pretty well-known novel. I feel like most people know the basics of it anyway, but I'll throw up a spoiler alert for all the Philistines out there. Spoilers. Okay. The romance between Kitty and Levin when I was reading the novel was actually like my favorite part, because everything that happened with Anna and Vronsky was like infuriating to me. And it's interesting that in this movie, the more emotionally resonant one is between those two, because that's kind of the entire point of the book. You're watching two parallel relationships kind of gestating and seeing the mistakes that each one makes and seeing the ways that they're constructed and what they're born of. And Levin even has a scene at dinner where he basically spells out the idea of the movie. Like, that certain kinds of love will actually enrich a life, whereas a certain other kind of love, while equally as intense and all-consuming, will unfortunately, you know, be the fire not that warms you, but that burns you to the ground. And so actually, you know, if both of you felt that was a little more emotionally resonant, like his and Kitty's relationship, then I feel like in a way the movie succeeded even in spite of your misgivings. I will latch on to that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like on some level the, like you talk about, this is supposed to be, these relationships are supposed to sort of like reflect a society. So they have this kind of like larger thematic representation. It's just like for me, the scenes between Keira Knightley and Aaron Johnson, their scenes at the beginning of the film are cool because that's when Joe Wright's kind of at his nuttiest in the movie. But as they go along, they just don't, they didn't work for me as drama. Like to me, the scenes between when Jude Law comes on screen and starts kind of talking to Keira Knightley, those scenes really came alive for me. But there's something about the Vronsky character that was just sort of like a blank slate. And if that's what it's supposed to be, like I can understand that, but it's still like didn't kind of hold my attention.
A lot of people have suggested that's what he's supposed to be. And yeah, I get the intention behind it because next to Jude Law, I think he looks very flat. And that sort of, yeah, it does make Anna's choice more interesting, but it also made me like her less because I was thinking to myself, what are you doing? Don't go with him.
That is exactly why the novel infuriated
me. It's an interesting creative choice, but not one that can necessarily, it kind of buckles under its own weight, I think.
I can, again, this is weird because I feel like this is the movie succeeding too much because I really,
it's too good.
I'm not saying that. I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be like, this is too smart for you. This is too anything. Like, I have no problem with people disliking a movie. And I hope that everyone at home knows that. I feel like I'm pretty good about being that way. But in this film, like, you are, like, the scenes between her, you were saying that Anna and Vronsky kind of become flat and less engaging as time goes on, but they start off like really interesting, like when they first meet, and then there's that crazy dance scene. I make that sound almost like something from Break-In. I mean, they do a long waltz together. Also, the music in this movie was great, I think. I loved it. I bought it on iTunes. So maybe it's just like there's something in the music. Maybe there's some subliminal message that makes me like this more. But I mean, they start off so great and so interesting and so involving, but then the longer that they're together, you do get this kind of weight that drags it down. And whereas her husband starts off as kind of this, you know, boring, stuffy, uptight guy, you know, the more his character has to come out, and I'm speaking of character not in terms of like his name and his age, but like his actual moral and honor-bound self, like starts to come out, you start to become more on his side. And suddenly, you know, like you said, Nick, her choice makes less sense. And I definitely think that that's what you're supposed to feel. I 100% affirm the idea that that is what was done on purpose.
That
I don't know. It's interesting to me because I loved this movie so much, and that's one of the reasons I was so excited to talk about it with you guys, because I do respect your opinions even when we disagree. And you know, there hasn't been too much conversation about this film, and that's really aggravating to me. I hate seeing a film like this and then having no one to talk to it talk about it with. So I was like, hit up Jeff Wells. He's the type of person who would threaten to kill Nick right now.
That's true.
And I don't want to be
that guy. That's a bridge to nowhere, yeah. Jeff Wells.
No, so I, you know, I'm not trying to convince you that you're wrong. I'm just trying to understand where you're coming from, trying to let you understand where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I don't take it that way.
All right, good. I just get worried about that sometimes. Because there is, you know, especially like after the whole Time debacle this week, where they said that Cloud Atlas was the worst film of the year. So not surprisingly, a lot of people turned to me and were like, hey, Brian, someone agrees with you. I was like, it's not the worst film of the year. I don't know why you would say that. So yeah, that was a weird tangent we just went on.
I don't think it's the worst film of the year either.
I'm glad that presumably none of us think that Cloud Atlas is the worst film of the year. In a year where The Devil Inside came out, it's hard to say that anything was the worst film of the year but that. Did anyone else see that movie?
Why would we see that?
I'm really, really upset to say that I missed that one.
Oh, yeah, no, it was a tragedy.
I very excitedly read the movie's Wikipedia page the day it came out, because the night before is when they had some screenings, and it was on Twitter. Everybody was going, seriously, The Devil Inside? What the hell?
Yeah,
I think I did the same thing.
Which, I mean, I could spoil it because who cares, but I will actually let you savor going to the Wikipedia page, scrolling to the bottom, and reading.
I love that you will spoil so many movies on this podcast just on the idea of, like, it came out 5 years ago, people should have seen it, but for some reason you draw the line at the devil inside.
Because there's a special value to be found in discovering that for yourself.
Yeah, I wanted to burn the theater down. But yeah, no, okay, so see, that would be my violent reaction. Let's try to get back on topic. I mean, yeah, this is a movie that I feel like would polarize people. I feel also that it will not get any awards love. I don't think it has been at all.
Yeah, which, probably crafts.
Craft service or like...
No.
Production like, design.
Costume.
Okay. I was about to say, wow, that's a low blow.
Either way, if you like the movie, who cares?
Yeah, no, but like I said, I like to get other people's opinion. I feel that talking about a movie helps me to appreciate it more and to understand my own tastes even more.
I think their opinion is that they don't believe it's award worthy.
Yeah. I don't have a problem with that. It's cool. Tree of Life didn't win much of anything.
I saw one of my favorite movies of the year this week, and I'm pretty sure it will not be getting awards. So,
okay,
I'm going to leave that hanging in the air.
I know what
you
saw.
I mean, he can't say what it is.
are you still under any kind of embargo?
I don't know.
All right, anyway.
Should I just keep making that sound?
Yeah, until you choke again. No, I mean, I loved Shame last year, and I don't think that got anything. Maybe I just have a thing for movies that are really good, or I find really good, that other people don't like as much and that will never get the awards I think they deserve.
You know, man, I just really like good movies.
Oh, man.
Something about them.
Something about good movies. Movies that make me feel something, which is why I'm surprised that neither of you said that you were really brought to any kind of emotional cohesion with this movie. That's weird to me.
Oh, I had emotion coming out of this movie.
Yeah, but it was anger.
It was funny.
Yeah,
honestly,
it's weird though, because when you're describing it, you don't sound like, you sound more like you're disappointed than like vitriolic anger.
I think it's because I saw this movie last week, so I've sort of come down from it, and at this point I'm thinking to myself, why expend the energy, honestly?
Okay, well, if we had talked to you last week and I said, what is the thing about this movie that it really raised your ire the most, what would that be?
It's soulless.
So it is the lack of emotion, the lack of...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I disagree with that.
I'm very glad. I actually saw this movie for free because I had a member's ticket to my local independent theater. Okay. So glad I saved that money.
That's weird. Again, I mean, unfortunately, that's the type of subjective thing that I can't really argue with you about. I thought that this movie had a lot of soul and a lot of heart, and I enjoyed the hell out of it. Yeah, that's weird. I can't believe it, dudes. That's nuts to me.
This will be on your top 10. I'll have Cosmopolis and Lincoln. And
you want to talk about Soulless? We can talk about Lincoln some more. Lincoln. I think I've grown to dislike that movie and Life of Pi even more as we've continued to talk about other films and I've seen other things. If you can believe me liking Life of Pi less.
Yeah,
that's a tough thought.
It is a pretty tough
thought.
I think
at this point you'll just stab Ang Lee to death.
I'm going to stab Ang Lee to death? I loved The Hulk. Does that count for anything?
Maybe. I'm not sure what that says, but...
I don't know what it says either. God bless him. All right, we're getting off topic. And actually, I think at this point we've come to kind of an impasse. We've talked about the movie pretty much in its entirety. We're in the spoiler section, but I mean, like, it's not like the end of this movie would crystallize your opinion one way or the other. Unless, of course, Anna's suicide did nothing for you, which, Nick, I feel like it didn't do anything for you.
It made me realize the movie was almost over, so it gave me joy.
Then you probably wouldn't have liked it in the book, because I think there's still 100 pages after she dies.
Oh, whoa. Yeah.
Again, the book is there was a point after
so
I
saw. So for Peter
this,
Jackson, that's a 2-hour, 50-minute movie.
Yeah.
Still left to go.
No, I was laughing. Because I read the book, like I said, and I went and saw this, and I turned to the person that I saw it with, and there's a scene where Levin is cutting grass, and that takes like a couple pages in the book, because not only is it, you know, it's Tolstoy, he's got a lot to say, and he likes to go into some details. And I was like, you know, if Peter Jackson directed this, this would be a 30-minute scene. Luckily, it wasn't. Someone other than Peter Jackson directed this. Is this a proper time to say that I'm really not looking forward to The Hobbit? I'm really not looking forward to The Hobbit, guys. We need
Except
more added
48 FPS.
I can't wait to not see it like that. I probably am going to, though, just because I keep hearing some
yeah,
polarized
I have to.
Opinions. Oh, because of a critic screening?
Yeah, it's That's what it's going to be.
There was a Salon piece that was called, like, Why Does the Hobbit Look So Weird? Mm-hmm. Just describing that. Someone was saying that, I guess this is just our way of closing out Anna Karenina. We can basically say that it's over. But someone was saying that technology for the camera has gotten so good that now, like, other technologies have to get better to catch up. And they were saying, like, costuming and props. And I was like, I'm pretty sure that they're just holding swords. Like,
yeah,
they made a big deal in the Lord of the Rings movies about how they personally stitched together chainmail. I don't think that props have to get better than real life. Like, that's when you have to do that.
Unless they're digital.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, the digital stuff, sure. Maybe the effects work needs some work. You can't depend on the blur that much. But, like, when you're saying that an actor looks like shit because people don't look real enough in 48 or whatever the hell it is FPS, like, then you've just got a problem. That's just an issue right there.
Yesterday, I was sent a link to this QuickTime video. It was the Hobbit teaser that came out about a year ago in not exactly 48 FPS, but it was a very close approximation of it. And yikes.
Zoinks.
Oy, that is going to be fascinating to watch for 3 hours.
I can't wait.
You will. Your eyes will probably not get bored. I'll put it that way.
That's fun.
Also because you'll be thinking, what the hell am I watching?
It makes me think of those mid-90s BBC miniseries that I used to watch on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Exactly what it looks like.
Also motion smoothing.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. Jesus. Not looking forward to it. And thus, I have to say that Anna Karenina was beautiful, and I'm so glad that it was not in that. I don't know. I just figured we have to bring this back to Anna Karenina for at least a second. Costumes, production design, fantastic. Am I the only one who liked the music? Did everyone else just kind of feel meh about it?
I didn't take much notice of it.
Yeah, nice. It was a good score. You know, those early portions with the dancing.
Yeah.
Memorable.
Yeah.
I thought that this could have used Love Fool by the Cardigans, like Romeo plus Juliet.
Oh, Jesus.
Because they're both sort of postmodern, or at least, you know, one tries to be a postmodern take on a classic love story. So when I love that song.
I thought you were going to say that when she takes the morphine, that she should have been listening to Heroin by Velvet Underground.
Mm.
Make a streak out of it. Anyway, that's our thoughts on Anna Karenina. I say go out and see it however you can. These two guys, not quite as enthusiastic about it, putting it lightly. Let's move on into what is coming out in the week ahead. Blu-ray releases for December 11th. I'm just going to stop saying DVD. I'm just going to keep saying Blu-ray. We have Ted, the talking bear thing directed by Seth MacFarlane. The Bourne Legacy following Christopher. Which one are you uhing about?
The Bourne Legacy.
Okay. We'll get into it. Following, which is Christopher Nolan's first film, Warren Beatty's Dick Tracy. We also have a bunch of Ice Age films, Blue Lagoon from the 80s, Heavyweights, the mid-90s classic, Girls, the HBO series is coming to Blu-ray. What is this? This is
the Copsy trilogy.
Oh, yeah. I missed that one. Les Miserables, the one with Liam Neeson's coming out. And, you know, there's a lot of other stuff that's hitting the discs. But those are kind of the big ones, unless you want to see Age of Hobbits, which I believe is the Asylum's knockoff of the Hobbit trilogy.
Wait, how did they get to see Hobbits?
I don't know. Wasn't there? There was a big to-do about that, wasn't there? There was some kind of lawsuit coming out.
Really? That term isn't... What the hell? I'm looking this up. In an age long ago, the last village of clever, peace-loving hobbits is attacked and enslaved by the Java men, Komodo-worshipping, dragon-riding cannibals.
Okay, wait. No, that sounds awesome.
I won't even keep going.
We all know how much I love Komodo dragons, so I'm totally down for that movie. What do we think is good that's coming out, guys?
Following is a fascinating movie, especially if you look at it from the standpoint of, from the perspective that it is Christopher Nolan's first film and how you can see traces of it in everything he's made since. For instance, one character has a Batman sign on their door.
Yes, there is.
Yeah, and it's cool that it's being released on Criterion. I'm really looking forward to picking that up. Also, the Katsi trilogy. I've never seen those films, but I've listened to the music more times than you can imagine, so I have a connection. Also, Girls, the first season, a show I love.
Boo.
I'm sure it'll look great on Blu-ray.
Boo.
This is a chance for me to make some kind of a lascivious joke about Allison Williams, but I will not.
I hated that series, man. That series is nuts. We've been through this before, I think, even. I don't know that it was part of a recorded conversation, but I will immediately lodge my contrary opinion. Girls is not good television. It's not good anything.
Yeah, it doesn't match the writing of Jay and Mark Duplass, but...
Okay. What?
Well, you're a big Duplass Brothers fan, so I took that as a chance to make a jab.
Yeah, but they don't really write. Like,
that was a diss.
I was about to say, but they don't write. They're usually pretty improvisational.
Yeah,
whatever. And they still do better than Girls. I feel uncomfortable even voicing my dislike of that show because immediately people are just going to call me a chauvinist.
Well, I don't agree with that.
Do you don't agree that I'm a chauvinist?
I don't agree with that kind of reaction to somebody not liking it.
Okay, well, that's good because I actually did voice my dislike of it once and was immediately shouted down. Yeah, the internet's not a friendly place to people who go against the grain, but, you know, whatever.
Well, I didn't like the pilot, so maybe that'll make you feel better or something.
I don't know, and it's one of those things, like, I saw each of those episodes, like, three times each up until, like, the second to last one, because I kept thinking there was something wrong with me. You know, maybe I just wasn't seeing something. I would see it blind, and then I'd read critical analyses, and then I'd go back, and...
Well, how could you enjoy it if you're blind?
Let's not diss the blind here. The blind. I meant Jesus Christ, Nick.
They can't hear it. That's deaf.
That's deaf people. Oh man, how many people can we offend? We now have women, the blind, the deaf.
The deaf are not going to be offended by a podcast.
The deaf again. No, I don't know. I have no problem with people who like Girls, but it's. My parents constantly make fun of me when I talk about a film in a certain way. They'll say that I'm trying to force some kind of importance onto it that might not otherwise be there, that I'm trying to make something I believe should be important as I think it should be. And I only really understood them feeling that way about me when I started reading about people who really liked Girls, the show, not the females. Anyway. Yeah, I don't know, guys. We can have a discussion about that.
Brian doesn't like girls.
I like women. That's what I'm saying. Anyway, fuck this. Let's move on. Ted was awful. Don't see Ted. The Bourne Legacy I also didn't like. Yeah, I'd have to go with Following, too. Danny,
Dick Tracy on Blu-ray. The movie's fun.
It's. I like the production design.
It's, you know, I mean, that is the best part, but it's pretty entertaining. I watched it last year, and I was surprised how much I actually enjoyed it. So
sweet. Danny, what about yourself, though?
Yeah, no, I have nothing to add. Didn't like Ted, didn't like Bourne Legacy, really like Following.
Okay. I won't tell you to see Heavyweights, because I'm just sure that that's one of those movies that, like, I loved as a kid, and now I'm going to hate it. So let's just move on. Coming out into theaters next week, December the 14th, we have Save the Date, a romantic comedy with Lizzie Kaplan, Alison Brie, Mark Webber. And other than that, we have The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey.
Yeah, that's the biggest one.
Yeah, everything kind of got out of the way of that. Looking at both of these, I actually would rather see Save the Date.
Oh, stop.
I'm actually kind of being serious. Have you ever seen Party Down?
Oh, wait. Oh, I know what movie this is. Okay. I don't know. Maybe that's understandable.
Have you seen Save the Date? Are you...
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but I love Alison Brie in Community. I love Lizzie Kaplan in Party Down. And I'd actually be interested to see both of them on the big screen. And, you know, I haven't seen a good romantic comedy in a while, so that could be fun. And just, again, like, The Hobbit does nothing for me. And it's not even like I'm not usually a fantasy guy, because I'm not usually a fantasy guy at all. But I still got pretty into The Lord of the Rings. But I feel like I saw as much of that as I ever could. So I don't know.
Also, yeah, I can understand that. I mean, The Hobbit is a very different story.
Yes, it is.
But
I don't know.
I mean, granted, it is about a Bagginses who leaves the Shire on a great adventure with Gandalf the Grey and a merry band of outsiders or people who are outside his own kin.
Yeah.
But I swear it is. And they have to go to a mountain, too. But I swear it is a very different story.
And they also have to deal with another all-powerful evil person who deals with fire.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, not person.
Okay. Well, neither Smaug the dragon or Sauron were really people, right?
Wasn't Sauron once a person?
I thought he was like just some...
He was the necromancer.
Is that who he is?
I believe so. And Benedict Cumberbatch, funny enough, is voicing both the necromancer and Smaug.
Good old Benedict. He's gone on a villain streak.
Yeah, he's playing Khan, sort of.
Sort maybe Khan, maybe something else. I don't know. Still haven't watched that trailer. I'll get around to it. Danny, what about you? What do you think of The Hobbit's An Unexpected Journey?
You know, I think it could very well have a journey that I won't be expecting.
But see, the problem with calling it an unexpected journey is that I am expecting the journey, and it won't be unexpected.
Well, so it's unexpected like, for
spoiler
Mr.
alert.
Bilbo Baggins.
That's true. This will be a year in which two different movies are released with a character named Bilbo.
That's right, yeah.
From Lincoln, if anyone doesn't remember.
What was the other one?
Lincoln.
Lincoln. James Spader.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So weird. Weird about that. I think I'm also just daunted by the fact that there are like 12 different faces on this poster.
The one with all the dwarves.
All the dwarves. That's just a lot of people. I can't.
That poster is basically designed to say, please don't see this movie.
Yeah. It's pretty bad. Especially you got like the really fat, funny looking one with like a roll in his mouth.
Yeah.
Jesus. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm going to see it. I'm going to give it its fair shake because I didn't think I'd like The Lord of the Rings, but I got into it. And I remember that was one of those movies that kind of made me feel like a little kid, you know, like, oh, shit, like this whole big world and there's action and battles and stuff. And so I'm hoping this one can drag me in. But I feel like the sheen is off the Shire and I'm more prepared and I'm just not that interested.
Yeah. One of the dwarves really looks like George Harrison, which is kind of weird.
I'm gonna try to find him right now. This could take me 4 months. I don't see it.
Okay.
Anyway,
I'm not sure.
You'll have to put. Oh wait, no, exactly. I do now. I think. Okay. Anyway, we'll get into it later, because we'll be talking about that next week. And I know I'm gonna try to see it in 48 FPS, so we can hopefully let that be part of our discussion as well. Since I know we did talk about that on one of our first episodes, because all that was just coming out of CinemaCon.
Yeah, it's how Peter Jackson wants people to see the movie, too, so...
Yeah, well, you know what? Fuck that guy. He can't tell me what to do. Wow, just calling
him. He says now he watches a 24 frames per second movie and he doesn't like the look of it, so...
I don't know. We'll get into it. I'm sure we'll talk about it next week. Let's move into the random things that we've watched that we feel that you all at home should check out. We always start with Danny this episode. Let's start with Nick.
All right. Let's do it. The movie I will recommend is Gus Van Sant's 2003 Palme d'Or winner, Elephant, which is based on the story of the Columbine shootings, or the story of the Columbine shootings? That sounds stupid. The actual Columbine shootings.
Yeah. That makes it sound like you don't even...
It is the second part of his Death trilogy, which is trilogy of movies about basically people who die, and they're based on true stories. The first one is Jerry... which is an incredible movie. If you haven't seen it, please do so. The third is Last Days, which is based on the last days of Kurt Cobain. And this film is probably the best known of them all, I would say. And yet it was the one that I had not seen. And boy, oh boy, this is a great film, but it is a tough, tough watch. I mean, there are moments in it where I thought I was going to have to pause the movie and just kind of walk around my room for a few minutes because it became too much to handle. The way Van Sant is positioning all of his characters and the way he's sort of examining their, you know, final day is so sort of... There's a lot of humanism and I guess, compassion in it, but it's also very blunt and in some ways has no boundaries to it whatsoever. So it's a great movie, but if you're going to watch it, be prepared, please.
Yeah.
I also saw the next day. I saw Promised Land, his new movie, which is very different but also good. So it's kind of funny how that worked out.
I love Elephant. Elephant is fantastic. I had basically the same reaction to you as you the first time I saw it. Like, just it's really hard to get through just because of everything that's going on. And it's one of those movies I like to spring on people. I do the same thing with Funny Games, which we've talked about. You know, I don't tell them what it's about, and people just kind of trust me now to know good movies. So I'll just like, hey, we should watch this. I won't tell you what it's about. Just trust me. And then
what
just,
is wrong with you?
Because I knew what Elephant was about when I saw it, so I feel like it was blunted for me a little bit. So seeing other people's reaction to it helps to affirm my feelings on it.
Have you seen Jerry or Last Days?
I have seen Last Days. I have not seen Jerry.
Okay. Do you like Last Days?
I did like Last Days.
You do?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
It's weird.
Yeah.
What's
funny is that this movie actually sort of recontextualizes one of the most famous shots in Jerry, which in that film is actually very funny. It's, you might remember there's a moment in the film where the two boys are looking at a map of their school when right before they're about to go there, and the camera takes the perspective of the map.
Yes.
Itself. What's funny is how it's played for laughs in Jerry, because it is basically a formal flourish that is spicing up what is the story of literally two people walking around the desert, mostly not speaking to each other. Here, the way he repackages it makes it all the more upsetting, I think. So I would say that if you're going to watch Elephant for the first time, maybe watch Jerry first. And even if you're not going to watch Elephant, watch Jerry.
All right. Excellent. And Danny, what about yourself?
I basically just quickly agree with everything you guys just said. And now I will go on to my own recommendation, which is Night Moves, a 1975 film from Arthur Penn, who directed Bonnie and Clyde, which is probably one of my favorite movies. And I hadn't even heard of Night Moves before this week. Have either of you guys seen it or heard of it?
No, I was just thinking of the Kelly Reichardt movie coming out.
I was thinking of the...
Is it the same title?
Yeah, Night Moves.
I was thinking of the song about... Are people familiar with the song, Please Don't Make Me Sing It?
No, I'm not.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, I'm not singing it. It's basically a guy thinking about this girl he used to mess around with, and they didn't like each other, but they just wanted to lose those awkward teenage blues, so they were working on their night moves. It's this whole big song about casual sex in the back of a car for an entire summer. It's pretty good. I don't know who sings it. It's an oldie.
Very, very interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, Night Moves, the movie.
Yeah, the film is really good. It sort of sets itself up as a standard kind of noir movie. Gene Hackman plays a retired NFL player who's now a private investigator. And you can sort of tell the movie's going to go in interesting directions, because the girl he's tasked to find, he basically finds like a half hour into the film. So you kind of know it's going to go to some interesting places. And the movie actually, the plot of it is almost incomprehensible. I still have no idea what happened, because the end just spirals out of control. But I've been reading about the movie, and a lot of people say it's kind of an interesting companion piece to The Conversation, in that Gene Hackman's characters in both films is named Harry, and both films kind of pit him within conspiracies that he just doesn't understand and that kind of drive him insane. So I kind of want to almost watch them back to back and just see what kind of insight can come from that. But Night Moves is definitely a good one.
Huh, I'd never heard of that. I am looking at the DVD cover now, and this is a terrible DVD cover. The movie sounds excellent, but this DVD cover is terrible. The tagline is, maybe he would find the girl, .. Maybe he would find himself.
Oh my gosh.
Right? That's bad. So yeah, again, marketing, poor decisions. Geez, guys, I'm thinking about it. What have I watched in the last week? A whole shitload of nothing. Actually, a little embarrassed. I don't think I've watched a single movie that's like older. Man, this is bad. I did see The Nutcracker last night. So if you're a fan of ballet, it is that season. Go out, check it out. It's still good. I watched The Dark Knight Rises. I went out and bought that on Blu-ray.
What is this movie?
I know, right? It's an older movie. From way back in like July. Jesus. Yeah. Apologies, everyone. I didn't watch anything this week. It's funny, because the last 3 weeks I'd watched just a whole mess of films. But Dark Knight Rises. You know what? This is a good chance for me to say, everyone who continuously nitpicks The Dark Knight Rises, I'm really starting to wonder how closely some people watch films. Because a lot of the nitpicks that I've absorbed, and I started to wonder to myself, like, man, maybe that movie was bad, or maybe it did leave these strings on the table and I just didn't notice. But no, it doesn't. There are totally, like, explanations for almost every minor complaint that people have come up with. So as long as your beef isn't Bane had a silly voice, which I don't personally agree with, but it's whatever, it's subjective. Like, go back, give it another look, and every time that you see, like, that honest movie trailers with the red letter media in there, like, make a note of their actual questions about the movie that are supposed to like tear it apart a little bit, and then actually watch the film and realize that Christopher Nolan isn't holding your hand through the whole thing, and he's not going to like flat out give you an answer. But there are so many contextual things, and it really affirmed my belief that it's a really great movie that for some reason was maligned for like no reason, except probably that like people were still high on the Avengers and suddenly Marvel was like the golden boy.
You know what's funny about that movie is that I do think there are inconsistencies to it in terms of the plot. I think there are elements that make no sense, but a lot of the complaints I heard lodged, you kind of sit, it's like what you said, you sit on it and you think, well, no, that actually does make sense. It's the film is so strange because I still really like it. I don't love it, so I'm not going to jump in and defend it. Not that it would ever need my defense in the first place, but so many people are coming out saying like, oh, that movie's really shitty. And I'm just thinking to myself, it's not. It's actually a lot of fun. And yeah, I don't know. It's weird because I really like it, but I don't feel the need to defend it. And I'm just kind of standing on the sideline.
I mean,
people scream at each other.
I usually don't feel the need to defend it. If it weren't for the fact that I had actually allowed all those people to like make me start to doubt my initial opinion, I wouldn't have said anything. Also, you know, if I'd watched another movie this week, I might have been able to talk about that, but I didn't. So, yeah, that's all I got. But yeah, seriously, watch it again. I mean, like you said, there are nitpicks, but it's funny because the same people who nitpick this one seem to defend the Avengers, and I think all three of us had a pretty good time laughing our asses off at that movie. Avengers, still, you know, still good. You should see it, but Jesus Christ.
You mean The Dark Knight Rises?
No, I mean, Avengers, I don't want people to once again jump to the Brian Rohn hates Avengers train. So I'm affirming the fact that I had fun at Avengers to an extent, though it's definitely more flawed than The Dark Knight, and yet The Dark Knight seems to get more flack. I think people assume that The Dark Knight is more serious, and therefore they are less forgiving of its presumed flaws.
It's very comic booky, that's the thing.
The Avengers?
No, The Dark Knight Rises.
Okay. Yeah, you know, it's more comic book than the other ones. I don't think people were prepared for that.
Yeah, so...
Anyway, this is... Yeah,
whatever. Right.
Anyway, Dark Knight Rises out on DVD and Blu-ray. I had a really hard time deciding which one to buy. I went to Best Buy, and there's like 17 different kinds that you can get. It was annoying. They really got to stop doing that shit. But anyway, that's it for today. We've gone about an hour and a quarter, so let's wrap it up, tell the people where we can be found in the interim, and then next week you can come back and listen to us talk about Hobbitses. Danny, why don't you start us off?
Filmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
Nick Newman.
Thefilmstage.com and twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And you can find me at thefilmstage.com as well as my personal blog, dearfilm.net. Here's a fun fact. I'm going to have a podcast coming out about having watched Red Dawn. That basically is just me yelling about the movie for an hour and how much it sucks. So, if you appreciate it when I go off the rails, you can look forward to that. I can also be found on Twitter, twitter.com/BrianJRowan. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Come back next week. We are out. So, today, anyone who... It just...